Welcome to another edition of Midweek Mysticism. We are continuing with the Tales of Abraham. So let's jump right to it. So we're in the middle. This will be a continuation. You may remember last time we discussed, just to place it again, that if there's a holiday, you have to give the poor gifts. You have to feed them. And if you don't, the kategor, the accuser, the Satan, will come and attack you for a celebration which is self-centered and not truly holy. And so that was the context. And there was a theological context to that too, about the tikkun of the world and the repair of the Shechina. That here the poor people represent the fundamental exile of the Jewish people, or the break in divine flow, or the poverty of the Shechina. And so here the poor become, just as everyone alive becomes a metaphor for some higher order spiritual concept in the Zohar. Maybe metaphor is not the right word, and we've had discussions about that too, but it becomes an embodiment of some higher order spiritual concept. So to the poor become an embodiment of the poor suffering Shechina, who is Dal, who is represented by the letter Dalid in the teaching of Rav Hamnuna Saba, which stands for the word Dal. I think we also mentioned that the fourth letter of the divine name stands for Shechina in the mystical tradition, the final hey of God's name. And that hey is the fourth letter, and the number four is Dalid, which stands for Dal, for poor. So the hey of the divine name is considered poor. The hey of the divine name is also a Dalid when it doesn't have the little vav. I think we mentioned that too, that if I draw a block letter hey, you could, of course, understand hey to be a Dalid and a Vav. You see that? Vav, Dalid. And this Vav, of course, is the prior letter. And so if you take the final letter of hey of the divine name and remove the Vav, that is the infusion from Tiferet, from Zer Antin above, then you're left with a poor, broken Shechina, or an incomplete name of God. Okay. And these are just kind of Kabbalistic axioms, as it were, that are a background to this teaching. Okay. Abraham gave and Zaman the Rabbi Zara. Do you see where we are here? Nachat Mikachagava Kamopitcha Kigavna Demiskinavalo Havaman Dashkachbe Abraham Hava Mishamish Linon Malchin Viravakin. Sarah, O Nikat Benin the Kulhu, Devahavi Mehemnan Kat Ihu Olidat Ella Amru, Asufehu, Uminshuka Aitiule, Beginkach Acham Benayu, Behadayu, Venitvat non Sarva, O Nikat non Kamayu, Adahu Dertiv, Mi Mileel Abraham, Hindika Vanim Sarah. I'll just keep reading. Banim Vadai, Umekachaka Pitra, Amrat Chok, Asali Elohim. As Abraham welcomed the dignitaries, so you recall what feast we're at? Abraham is at the feast for the weaning of Isaac. Is that what this feast is? And as Abraham welcomed the dignitaries, the accuser descended and stood at the door, disguised as a poor man. No one paid him any attention. Abraham was waiting on those kings and princes. Sarah was suckling all their babies because they did not believe that she had given birth. Now, why did they not believe that she had given birth?
She's old.
She's old. Good. Just making sure everyone's awake. No, nothing magical about that question, right? They said, it is a foundling from off the streets. This is a fake miracle, like the televangelists on TV, when suddenly people are healed and they can see and walk. Abraham did that. We had a baby. No, you stole a baby from the streets, they said. So in order to prove that they really had a baby, Sarah served as a wet nurse, according to this wild Zohar, to all the babies at the party, to prove that her milk supply was large, to show that she really gave birth and was, so to speak, young. When they brought along their babies, Sarah took them and suckled them in front of everyone. As it is, so Sarah, the picture of the party, Sarah is just nursing every baby right in front of everyone to prove the point. As it is written, who would have said to Abraham, Sarah will suckle children? Children, literally. Wait a second. Children? There's one child we're talking about. So why does it say, Hinika Vanim Sarah? She will suckle children. Now, of course, the plain verse, Hinika Vanim Sarah, Mimi Leal, Hinika Vanim Sarah, who would say Sarah will suckle children, doesn't mean literally many children, but rather means we'll have children. One child, many children. It's not about the number of children, just the concept that Sarah could have a child is here generalized as vanim, children. But the Zohar, as it does sometimes, says a hyperliteral reading. Who would have said Sarah will suckle children? Many children, literally, plural children. That is to say, she suckled her child, Isaac, and all the other kids too. Okay. Meanwhile, the accuser was still at the door. And by the way, there are many other midrashim that fall into the genre of, did they really have kids? Like the midrash that Isaac looked like Abraham in order to prove Ela told Avram Yitzchak, right, Rashi, that Isaac looked in order to prove the point that Isaac was a child. There's a whole set of occurrences that need to happen, or midrashic readings that really actually are just manifestations of the doubt that actually that this miracle was real. Okay. Meanwhile, the accuser was still at the door. She said, God, Tzchokas al Elohim, God has made a laughing stock of me. Now, what does it mean in context? Tzchok asa li Elohim. Maybe we should open the Tanakh. Open it up here. Do you see me browsing? Or something else?
No, just a blank spell, yeah.
Okay, I'm looking here. Going a little slowly. My network is good. Should be going quicker. Right. So I think the shot of, okay. So she has a kid. Yeah?
God has made laughter for me.
Yes. Okay, here we see from the JPS translation. Batomer Sarat Sechok Asali Elohim Kola Shomer Yitzchak Yitzchakli. Isn't it Yitzchakli? I'm questioning the vowelization here. On it's always dangerous territory to be saying, is that really how it should be? I think it's Kola Shomer Yitzchakli. Okay. I think Sfarim may be inaccurate in its vowel. Why?
Difference in the root on the High Holidays. Now, the JPN and Grad manuscript, which has Yitzchakli, but the, let's say, the older, quote, Masoretic texts, literals, you know, the ones that we usually use for the Herz Chumash, have Yitzchak. So it's a manuscript difference.
Wow. Okay. Well, I'm going to read it then the way I'm used to reading it, but thank you, Rabbi Confer, for being on the ball with the manuscript So this is fine, but the way I learned the verse, Kol Hashomea Itzachakli. In any event, Sarah said, God has brought me laughter, not made me a laughing stock, as the Zohar is working with it. Just it's because it's not always clear when Matt translates the text or the Zohar, like where they're departing from the plain reading of the text and inserting. So in your edition, you know, you might want to make a note. The plain meaning of the text is a positive meaning, playing on the meaning earlier, right? Tzchok does have this sense earlier when she hears she's going to have a child, that that's ridiculous. But here, and this is the beauty of the narrative, that laughter is reversed from kind of mockery to joy, right? Everyone who hears will laugh in joy, not mockery, with me. Just a side note, I think it is interesting in the account of Sodom, the Shoresh of Tzchok, of laughter, again comes up and becomes pivotal in this story. So query, what is the relationship between this story and the subsequent account of the destruction of Sodom? That's just an observation while we're on the Shoresh. So back to the Zohar for the moment. Okay, God has made a laughing stock of me. So what does that mean? The Satan hears her saying, what does the Satan hear her saying? He hears Tzechokas of the Elohim, not I'm so joyed, right? But here this positive account is like, no one believes I had a kid. That's the ambiguity of the text, right? And so when she said Tzechokas of the Elohim, here that verse is reworked in this midrash. So now she had a kid, Hinika Vanim, she's nursing all the kids. And the fact that she has to nurse all the kids is proof that she's a joke. God, in fact, didn't do a kindness. He made her the laughing stock. Okay, back to the text. Zohar. Miad. Sadikahu mekadraga kamikucha brihu va amrle ribon alma at amart Avraham ohavi avatsu de tabelo yahavach midi. Lab lumiskini, la karib kadama hafilu yona had. The two amrat sara de chaychatba. Amrle kucha brihu, man be alma ka Avraham. Lo zazmi tamana de bibev kala hi chedba. Pakid kucha brichu the mikra v'yitchak korbana v'itgazar al sara de tamut al tzara divra kalahu tzara garim to lo yahiv midi lemiskane. At once the accuser rose to face the blessed holy one, exclaimed, "Master of the universe, Ribon Alma, you called Abraham. Abraham Oavi, Abraham, my beloved," in Yeshayahu, which is the Haftorah for that week, I think. "He held a feast and gave me nothing and nothing to the poor. To you, he didn't offer even a single dove. Furthermore, Sarah said that you made fun of her, Tzechok Asav Elohim, or you made fun of her, like you made her a joke." Right? Now a dove, as Matt notes, is the kind of lowest level of the sacrifices for people who are poor. He didn't give anything. The Blessed Holy One replied, "Who in the world is like Abraham?" But he held his ground until he ruined all that joy. Did we read this? Yeah, we did. Did we read it in the Aramaic? I'm trying to remember. I think we did. "But he held his ground until he ruined all that joy, and the Blessed Holy One commanded that Isaac be offered as this." Commanded that Isaac be offered as a sacrifice. "And it was decreed that Sarah die in anguish over her son's ordeal. All that suffering came about because he gave nothing to the poor." So in this version of the story, Several people have gesticulations and expressions. Something's going on here. So, well, does anyone want to make a comment before I say anything?
I have a question. So, yeah. Counted four sins at the one feast: not giving something to the accuser, not giving anything to the poor, not sacrificing to Hashem, and Sarah saying that she was a laughing stock. And why in summarizing it do we just focus on giving nothing to the poor after they've laid on the whole long list of sins?
Right, I see. You're saying there are many problematic elements of this feast in the Zohar, yet the one that was the whole background to this teaching was you got to give to the poor. And here's a story about Abraham. So it could be that this story just illustrates that teaching. And it happens to illustrate other points as well. In other words, we had a teaching that you have to give to the poor. And by the way, here's a mystical midrash about Abraham. And one of the things Abraham didn't do was give to the poor. Or there could be a convergence here between giving to God and giving to the poor and giving to the Satan.
And avoiding the sacrilege of Sarah complaining that she'd been made a laughing stock.
Yeah, I don't know. It's easier to lump all the others together in my mind.
The Sarah one is blamed on God. God made Sarah a laughing stock, whereas Abraham did the other three. So that's sort of in a different category.
It's a fair point. By the way, I also want to flag, and I wasn't sure how much of a detour to take, another one of the tangential points, Peter, which is that he didn't give the Satan anything. Well, are you supposed to offer to God and also to the Satan?
I was going to ask, is that like a second goat offering or something like that? Like, is that what the reference is?
Ah, I'm glad you asked. So a lot of the commentators here cite the second goat, the Seir La'Azazel, as the paradigm for this. Wow, that was like a plant. We couldn't have planted that better. So just hold that thought for a moment. But I don't know if we've answered you, Peter Salson. I didn't want to say, I think this may be a case where the Zohar wanted to say something about the theological value of giving to the poor. And then by, they cited a teaching, look at Abraham's party, where that and other things went wrong.
The Matnote 546 is interesting if we read that.
The what?
Daily Math's note 546 addresses that question. I know some people have it in front of them.
Elsewhere, the Zohar indicates that the demonic powers should be assuaged by giving them their share, as a bone is thrown to a dog. See, Pirkei to Rabbi Eliezer 46, they gave him Satan a bribe on Yom Kippur, the scapegoat, so he would not nullify Israel's sacrifice. According to Leviticus 16, a goat bearing the sins of Israel is designated for Azazel, a wilderness demon. Similarly, in the Babylonian Akitu ritual, a goat substituted for human being is offered to Arishkigal, goddess of the abyss, according to this matnote. And I will say, now that we're here, and it is a little bit of a distraction, but nonetheless, it's hard to mention it. By the classic source on this is the Ramban on the Seir La'Azazel. Has anyone ever read the Ramban on the Seir La'Azazel before?
Ibn Ezra has a code at the end, and he said, I learned this from Rabbi Ruman, Allah Shalom. Ibn Ezra's code at the end is, if you know the sod of the 36 or something like that, and if you look 36 verses ahead of the Azazel, it comes to, you should not sacrifice to the Seirim. And Leland says that Ibn Ezra knew the pshat, which was that Azazel was the goat demon of the desert.
Right. So, good. So let's look at parts of this Ramban, if that's okay. Now, this is instructive because the Ramban is also a Spanish Kabbalist of roughly the same time period, just in a more conservative school of Kabbalah. So what's helpful here is that we can kind of see the Zohar echoing traditional schools of Kabbalah in its treatment of Abraham, which might lead us to feel that this is not its most innovative teaching. Yeah, this is a classical teaching. Quotes a lot of Midrash, so I just want to go to where the Ramban is actually saying things. Okay, so Ramban says here, Mufurash Mizeh B'Pirkei Rebbe Eliezer Agadol. That's the Pirkei to Rebbe Eliezer that actually Matt just quoted, I think. Did he quote 46? So the Ramban quotes the Pirkei to Rebbe Eliezer also inside. B'fikach hayu notnim lo l'sma'el shochad b'yom ha-kippurim shol levatel et korbanam. It's a little more shocking in its actual language to me. Therefore, they gave to Sma'el, and Sma'el is considered the the chief of the demons. Also, traditionally in the Kabbalah, one of the two angels that escorts you home on Friday night, who may be forced to be a good angel, which is kind of the power of that whole Shalom Aleichem tradition, which is that there's always a good angel and a bad angel that escort you. That's not the novelty of the Friday night Shalom Aleichem, that an angel escorts you home from synagogue if you that is made in your table list and whatever. The chidush of it is that even the bad angel escorts you home and it becomes your protector. And that bad angel, of course, is Ismael, who we might not say his name in some context, but we say it in this year, I guess. And there is one verse which finds its way by the Kabbalists into the davening because it has the Rosh Tevot for this name in it. I don't know if anyone knows that verse. Bring my Siddur. Hold on 1 second. Okay, maybe we shouldn't get lost on the name. Let me just read the Ramban. We're already on a tangent. I'll come back to that. Okay, so the point is they would give Ismael a bribe on Yom Kippur, shelo levatel korbanam, so that this demon not cancel their sacrifices. Shenamar goral echad v'Hashem goral echad v'Azazel. Goralo shel kadosh baruch hu lekorbanu lav, goralo shel azazel siyar achatat. V'chol avonotem sheyisrael lav, shenamar v'nasas siyar lav. Ra'as ma'el, shelo nimsa b'em chet, b'yom kippurim. Amar v'nei kadosh baruch hu. So here they bribe Ismael in order to make Ismael an advocate on Yom Kippur. Let's just keep reading it. So that Ismael should not find any chait. You know, they just, you know, gave him a little treat. Yom Kippur. Amar lefnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Ismael says before God, Ribon kol olamim. Yesh lecha mecha be'eretz kemalech esher, yesh sheba shamayim. There's only one nation in the land, like the angels in heaven. Ma malech esher, right, there's this one foot thing. Angels don't eat, the Jews don't eat on Yom Kippur. The angels, you know, fly around in Israel, stand on their feet. There's peace, so Israel is peaceful, etc. The parallels go on and on.
They wear cheap sneakers on Yom Kippur.
Kach Yisrael nikim mikol chayt b'yom kippur. The angels are free of sin. The Israelites are in cheap sneakers, free of sin. V'akadosh Baruch Hu Shomei Dutan Shi Israel. Obviously, cheap sneakers was not the ideal. The ideal was no shoes. HaKadosh Baruch Hu listens to the testimony of Israel, about Israel, Mina Kategor, from the prosecutor. The prosecutor recommends a lenient sentence for Israel. And of course, the judge is forced to comply with the prosecutor's sentencing recommendation. Wait, politics and Zohar are again blurring. And it causes atonement on the altar of the Mikdash, Vala Kohanim, Vala Kol HaMakal. And everyone atones for the nation and for the sanctuary, for everything. Okay. Adkan Agada Zo. That's the end of this Agada from Birkei Dereb Eliezer. Vine Odienu Shmo Maseu B'Zeh Sod Anyan. Here's the matter of Ikai. Ovdim Lelohim Achirim, Ema Malachim Osim Mem Korbanot. Look, says the Rambam, the Torah forbid entirely any acceptance of the godliness of these other gods. And any, you can't worship foreign gods, says the Rambam. Didn't the Torah prohibit idolatry? What's going on here? How are we aval? But Siva Kadosh Baruch Hu beYom Kippurim, God commanded on Yom Kippur, Shenishalech Seir Bamidbar, that you send a goat into the desert, L'Sara Moshe B'Mkomot HaKorban, to the prince who rules over those destroyed places, to Azazel, the desert god. And it's fitting for him because he's in charge there. And look, how does a place become destroyed, like the desert, desolate, like the desert, says the Rambam, from the confinement or the restriction of God's strength? In other words, it's the absence of God. And that's where destruction and desolation comes from. God is the one that causes the constellations of destruction. Vadamim and blood. Vamilchamot and the wars. Vamirivot and the rebellions. Vapsayim and the wounds. Vamakot and the illnesses. Vaperud and the discord. Vachorban and the destruction. The Aklal Nefesh, the Gagel. Madim. So, and God is the one who gives power, animates the soul of the constellation of the one with the scales. What's that one? Everyone's an astrologer here. The constellation with the scales and the zodiac.
Capricorn?
Pisces?
No, it's fish.
All right, well, query which one of
those kinds of scales? Sorry.
No, Libra. Not the fish scales, the scales of jealousy. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Libra. I just looked it up. Libra.
I should know this. I'm a Libra. I was born on Erev Sukkot. It's my constellation. It's the constellation of that time of year. Yes, the constellation during Yom Kippur is Libra. God's the one who put Libra in charge in September and early October. The Chokominomotu Asoshu Amayoresha Kareva Mochamotu Minabemota Sirimba Izim Uvechoka Oda Hashedim and Akrim Mizikim Boshan Rabotenu. And look, these demons are called Mizikim, damagers in the language of our rabbis, etc. It's not a korban. It's not a sacrifice made tanu from us. God forbid. We're just doing what God said. That he commanded us to give a thing to the one in charge at this time. Okay, and he gives a mashal. Anyway, so the Ramban goes on and on. There's like 10 more pages of this Ramban here. But that is to say, it's a rather shocking Ramban in that he basically endorses a form of divinely sanctioned idolatry. And it's the divine sanction of it, which basically is the thing which makes it not just not forbidden.
If you were to turn that into psychological terms, he's saying, dealing with evil forces, you have a choice between suppression and accommodation, and he recommends accommodation. In other words, if you have a certain feeling for violence or something else, there are ways to channel it which are acceptable to God.
Now, one can only imagine, I don't know if Maimonides ever commented directly on this comment, on this passage. I'm sure he did. But this would have been thoroughly shocking and idolatrous to Maimonides, for whom the whole Torah was to refute primarily idolatry as a legitimate thing. But you're right. I would agree. And the Hasidim often psychologize this very line of thought, which is to say that, you know, evil, you can't suppress evil. And at times you have to flirt with evil or incorporate those aspects of the demonic.
I think Maimonides would be okay with that, because what you're saying, because he is big on the thing that these rituals are intended to wean us in one direction that you can't go to. So is prayer, and so are all these things. In one sense, they're idolatrous and are based on absurdities. But if properly directed, they serve a divine purpose.
Yeah, I don't know if he would have ever said, gone so far as to say, though, that, you know, you could be weaned from idolatry by giving a little something something to the demons.
He sort of does say that in more of the victim. The reason God lets us keep doing all of these sacrifices, which are more or less identical in form, although not in substance, to idolatrous practices.
Right, in form. But he would have never said, you know, there is a demon. What he would have never said is the following. There is a demon who is embodied in the constellation of that time. And that demon only exists because of God's concealment, intentional concealment, which gives rise to the demonic force, which is what the Ramban says here. And it is God who commands you then to give the bribe fitting to the demon in charge of the desert at that time of the year, that place in that time. And what makes it okay is that God, in other words, Rambam would always have only God being the one you can worship. In fact, I would say this violates one of his ikarim, right? That you can only worship him. You know, in other words, this is divinely sanctioned worship of a foreign deity. That's what the Ramban has this being, just to be clear. So that's where I think it crosses the Maimonidean line. Maimonides might have had it just be the remnant form of a thing, but to God, whereas, you know, the plain meaning of the Torah, as Rabbi Confer noted, to the demons that you sacrifice, is that this is to the goat demons. So in any event, there we have it. This tradition of offering something to the Satan or the accuser is taken for granted by the Zohar as already existing in Kabbalistic schools. And the Ramban is just echoing the Spanish Kabbalistic schools, which understand that forces of evil need to be keep your friends close and your enemies closer. You know, they need to be bribed, paid off, dealt with appropriately, or, you know, brought into the coalition, as it were. Okay, so now we have the end of the story. He held his ground until he ruined all that joy, right? And so because of this, the prosecutor didn't relent. And so what happens, and this all happens very quickly in the Zohar, God commands that Isaac be offered as a korban, as a punishment here. This is not echoed in the rabbinic tradition anywhere else, so far as I know. There are causal links between this feast and the Akedah, but never is it understood that because Abraham did something wrong at the party, God punishes Abraham by having him offer Isaac as a sacrifice. And then it was also decreed that Sarah die in anguish over her son's ordeal. Of course, it is true that in the rabbinic tradition, the midrashic tradition, Sarah sees a vision of the Akedah, doesn't know the real end, and dies of heartbreak or panic. Here, that is a kind of preordained and obvious result of the sin of this party. So the party sin results in the Akedah, and also Sarah's inevitable death from the Akedah. All that suffering came about because he gave nothing to the poor. Now, just to note, this is the one thing I'll add from myself, not seeing it anywhere, but the literary beauty of this Zoharic passage is that because of a refusal to give the poor at a meal, which was linked earlier to a kind of idolatrous worship. In other words, if you have a feast but don't give to the poor, is it really worship of God? If you have a feast but don't give to God, is it really worship of God? If you have a feast but don't sacrifice to the demons, is it really worship of God in this extreme version of it? So what's the punishment? The punishment is that Abraham is commanded to do a thing which is basically idolatrous, which is to offer Isaac as a human sacrifice. And so the penalty for sort of a monotheistic idolatry, it's a feast celebrating the monotheistic God's miracle to Abraham, but is perceived to occur in a way that is self-centered and therefore idolatrous, is almost to say, what do we need this monotheism for anyway, if you're just going to celebrate yourselves? It's just another. And so the Zohar is again riffing on the themes it's been riffing on from the beginning and recently when it's talked about the power of tzaddikim and how they are gods, literally gods, and challenges. They're greater than God, says the philosopher in your weird tradition. And the Kabbalists are like, sure they are. We're all gods today. And so this is kind of working with that and saying, and you know, it's easy to turn what seems like a righteous feast celebrating a good thing. It's really easy. They're just not noticing the poor. People don't want to notice. It's uncomfortable. Usually they smell and they're awkward and they have mental health, right? People don't want to notice poor people. It's really easy to turn your religious practice into a form of idolatry, real idolatry. And here the Zohar may be saying something else, which is that real idolatry isn't mainly theological, but psychological or egotistical or self-centered, right? In other words, they're running around with themes of polytheism and idolatry, but the real idolatry is not giving to the poor. And the monotheistic God might punish that with the quintessential act of idolatry, human sacrifice, because that's not what matters. So I actually think the Zohar is making a statement here about what matters and what doesn't matter, and addressing some of the intuitive challenges of rationalists and philosophers and monotheists to its system by telling you a story. We have a story, you know, it's called the Akedah. We want to tell you a different version of the Akedah story, one of real idolatry. The one where Abraham and Sarah, the great paradigms of Chesed, forgot about the poor people. That's the real sin. So,
it sounds like what you're saying just at the end, like when Peter first raised the question, why do they only list nothing to the poor here at the end when three or four separate offenses had been listed earlier? You suggested at the time that, well, this overall passage is about nothing to the poor, so that's why they're focusing on it. But I think just now you suggested something deeper and therefore more interesting, which is that giving nothing to the poor is like a real life manifestation of idolatry, which can be, you know, a bigger theological thing. And so there's a sense maybe in which giving nothing to the poor captures the essence of like real life idolatry. And so it represents all of these things.
Yeah. I don't understand that argument. Why is not giving to the poor related to idolatry? You can easily believe that there are multiple gods and all sorts of gods like you to give to the poor. If you go to any idolatrous shrine, it's full of poor people. Because that's always the case, is the assumption that all gods like to take care of widows and orphans and protect them if they get to their temple.
So I assume it's that if idolatry is failing to worship the true worship-worthy object, namely Hashem, but for example, becoming very self-interested and only thinking of yourself, that becomes a form of idolatry. So not giving to the poor is this selfish self-centeredness. And that's therefore giving more weight or reverence to yourself than to the proper target of reverence. So that's the connection.
I think that's what it's talking about, but I don't think the issue is idolatry.
Well, it is. If idolatry is understood as putting your worship in the wrong place, right? That's
I think it's more the concept that God or a God makes himself available for physical objects. And you can be a monotheist and believe in idolatry, as some of our Christian friends do. And you can be a polytheist and be very opposed to idolatry.
Whether it is technically idolatry or not, and I would take the pessimist approach here.
I think
what this is saying is whether we call it idolatry or not. So
vague as it means everything.
Whether, I don't know if I lost you, whether...
Rabbi, you froze?
Oh, do I have you all? Yeah, I would endorse the pessimist hypothesis. They are feeling, I think, in this passage that it is a kind of form of idolatry, which is to say fundamentally misplaced worship that reveals something about the whole party, which is why the party is worthy of this kind of murderous destruction and the death penalty of Sarah. And I think the nature of the penalty, sacrifice your firstborn son, hints at their feeling about this as idolatrous. But nonetheless, the clear, plain sense of the passage, absent my interpretation of it, this is my interpretation, is that this thing, not giving the poor, is the thing that gets the accuser, the Satan, to be able to institute a serious penalty. Whether we classify that sin as idolatry or stinginess or just egocentricity, it could be idolatry or it could just be a plain fatal character flaw. But either way, the passage remains, if that makes sense. I want to say one other thing, which is that the Zohar may be describing the narrative of the Akedah and giving us an account of how it is that chesed, loving kindness, fails to manifest in the world, which is that even kind people, this is that most, it may be giving an account, and maybe entering into like Rousseau and Hobbes and like a discussion of the natural state of the world here, because the Olam Chesed Yivaneh, the world is built on loving kindness. So if the world is built on loving kindness and people are created in the image of a loving God, what happened? Asked the Zohar. And so this is another account of the natural state, a Zoharic account, not a Hobbesian account or anything like that. And it's kind of saying, well, you know what happened, which is that really kind people, in fact, Abraham is the kindness of God embodied in the world, that sphera. But it gets caught up in itself. There's a lack of transcendence with everything else that exists, or a self-centeredness, and that is causes an ultimate restriction of divine flow. We'll start the next teaching if people are okay with that for 5 minutes, just to preview it.
Yeah.
Could I ask a question about the how this fits into the received understanding of the Akedah?
Yeah.
So maybe this is a punishment. Maybe it's God proving to the Satan that Abraham is faithful. But you know, as I understand our received understanding of the Akedah, the ultimate proof that Abraham is ultimately virtuous, and we benefit from the merit of that. But here, it's being presented as something morally ambiguous or worse. He passes the test, but it's still not something that I would see us celebrating all the time.
So the rabbinic tradition of the Akedah, the Midrashic tradition of the Akedah, definitely has this kind of dialogue in several places between an accuser, between a Satan and God, recreating a Job-like dynamic where this accuser figure kind of eggs on God to test his supposedly righteous guy. just in this case, it's not Job, it's Abraham, but it's almost the same story.
And what is that testing, really? They're not testing righteousness. The test is one of obedience.
Well, according to the narrative of the text,
that's a big difference. You can be involved in evil activity out of obedience to God. I mean, that's basically Abraham.
What they're testing, the key word in the Akedah passage is yireh. Is fear. Bahar Hashem yireh. They even pun it on the name of the place. And that place, God's name will be seen. But it's a pun on yireh, on fear. Yirat Elohim ata. Now we know, right? Yireh Elohim ata, that you are a God-fearer. So it doesn't say
we know you're righteous. It just says we know you're obedient.
We know you fear God.
We know you fear us and you're surrendering to us. You're not giving us this line like you did with Sodom and Gomorrah that, hey, if you were really as righteous as you say you are, you wouldn't do this. You drop
it. Either way, Abraham's passing of the test is considered ultimately righteous or something. Whereas what I take away from this is that the whole existence of that test is pointing out a fundamental failing of Abraham.
Yeah, this is a totally different, you know, the Zohar might say the Akedah was a tragedy that resulted from Abraham's own and what is the thing that blinded Abraham and caused him to get so self-centered? Having the kid. In other words, Abraham was so kind and righteous while he was suffering, but once he got what he wanted, and the Zohar may be actually telling us a worship secret, which is the time to watch out is actually when you, because of your very righteousness, which is why Abraham gets a miraculous kid, get what it is that you think the miracle happens to you because you're such a great guy and so righteous and God-fearing. And it's precisely at that moment that you could get haughty, even for a moment. And during that moment, it could all get undone. It could all come unraveled. And so it's in some ways a really, it sees the Akedah as a cautionary tale. And the details of the Akedah are almost unimportant for the Zohar in this statement of it. The Zohar has its own treatment of the Akedah at some length. So it would be interesting to compare this to the longer treatment of the Akedah. But at least in this teaching, the Akedah is a tragedy that unfolds. Whatever Abraham does, if he slaughters him, it's going to be bad. If he refuses to go, he's disloyal. And even when he goes and listens to God, and in the end, God, the angel stops him, Sarah still dies. So the whole thing is just kind of a tragedy. I don't know if tragedy, it seems to me it's the right genre to place that. The Zohar thinks the Akedah, the existence of the Akedah itself is a preventable tragedy.
But that's an interesting, I think, because that is really, and I think Peter highlighted this, I mean, it puts in tension an idea of the Akedah being anisa in Rambam and other places, like when he talks about the progression of prophecy, he kind of puts it in that idea of like it's a test that Abraham is going to pass to get to another level of prophecy, basically, or the way that it almost feels like it's a kapara, basically. What we're saying is it's in fact like a punishment in some ways to redeem Abraham for what he did. So there's a tension here, I think. It's interesting that the Zohar is coming down on this idea of the Akedah being kind of a kapara rather than a nisa to get to like another level of spirituality.
Yeah.
Now, in just one or two teachings, the Zohar is going to go on about Abraham as wonderful and Isaac and Jacob too. So I think maybe the placement of that with this is kind of meant to mitigate, like we have a really short teaching and then a teaching about, this next teaching is going to talk about how great Abraham is in a certain respect. So I think they even felt their own tension. Like, okay, we better put one good one about Abraham right after this, because he is Abraham. You know, let's just put something hagiographic and wonderful. But yeah, so in any event, that represents today's conclusion of the Zohar takeaway lesson. Be careful when you get what you wish for. That may be the takeaway lesson of today's Zohar. And of course, the Zohar does it in its characteristically cryptic yet tantalizing. I think that's the word for the Zohar. It teases us with layers of meaning. So thank you everyone for joining. It is good to be back. We'll continue next week. Same bat time, same bat channel. Next week's topic, what should you do right before you go to Daven? Shacharis, Mincha, and Maariv. There's something you got to do before you Daven. Or what does it mean to Daven? So we'll get a good teaching. It's a short one. We'll probably be able to do the whole teaching next week.
Thank you.
Bashalom, Yeshkoach.